What's this?
Whiskey. They're bringing me stuff now.
Who's bringing you stuff?
So I will introduce you. This is John the butcher over here and his wife Nelsie. They run the chop shop. He used to be a butcher at Balducci's for a bunch of years, then opened up the coolest butcher shop across from Inferno. And part of the reason why I wanted him here tonight is because he's meats and you've got some really cool stuff, and it's one of those things that we'll talk about. But this is Law's four grain whiskey blend out of California. They're pretty good. I like them.
They're pretty good.
Would you like some more rosé?
Yeah, I can do that.
I got it. You were pouring everything else. Let me pour for you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome once again to our next hopeful potential edition of the Liquid Storyteller podcast. I am your host, Nick Matarese, the Liquid Storyteller, and I am joined by one of my all-time favorite people on the planet, Rachel Lippman, the winemaker for Low Vineyards, and all around just wine know-it-all, which is always fun for me to have somebody else that knows more than me. Tonight, we're diving into Malbec. At this point of the year, everybody starts talking about Pinot Noir, Thanksgiving, Pinot Noir, Thanksgiving, Pinot Noir, Thanksgiving. And my original idea for this podcast was to say, let's do something completely alternative. And I was looking at doing wines from Arizona and actually Turkish wines for Thanksgiving, because I thought that would just be a fun play. But then it hit me. Why don't we talk about Malbec? And everybody talks about how Malbec is such your great steak wine, your beef wine, your meat wine, your barbecue wine. But I also think that we've gotten to the point with Malbec where it sort of is on this precipice of being misunderstood, because it's gotten so popular so fast, much like Merlot before Sideways, and I'm not drinking any F in Merlot. And I think that it's time to look at Malbec in a little bit of a different light instead of just your hamburger and steak wine, because it's a very fun grape, and it's got a lot of different faces to it, as you can see just by starting out with having that rosé of Malbec. Anybody not had a rosé Malbec tonight? I know there are a lot of you that have been to some of our tastings and maybe suffered through drinking all of Martin's wines with us. Anybody, was this your first Malbec rosé? All right, so you guys are all educated and wonderful. Hi, welcome. We'll still get you wine. In fact, we already poured you some just in case. So Malbec rosé was what I thought would be the great thing to start our palates off and get us going. From there, we're going to dive right into full-on Malbec red goodness and ridiculousness. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to start, pour wine number one into your glass. We are going to begin with the Mil Historias Organic Malbec from Manchuela. And I'm going to have a little drink of rosé first. Rachel, do you want to share anything about the rosé with everybody?
The rosé producer it's from Cahors, and that producer is very integral to why I make Malbec the way that I do. Martin's a very interesting guy because it's a French producer, but he's Belgian. And if anyone's been to France before and knows how the French feel about Belgium and Belgians, It's a really interesting mix of the fact that he's actually Dutch, right? Kind of.
He has Dutch roots.
Yeah.
Dutch. Belgian.
Yeah. He looks Dutch.
He's like the super Euro.
Yeah. So now he's all into biking. when I was introduced to his wines, I really had a light bulb moment, because his wines are a lot more of what Malbec, in my perspective, is supposed to be like.
Can we just broach that dirty little secret of yours right now so we get it out in the open for everybody? Your love-hate relationship with this grape?
Yeah, I like Malbec and I don't like Malbec. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, well, it actually originates in France, in Cahors in France. And when it's produced there, it's produced in a way that it, the way that the variety was intended to, in my perspective. And then we do see a lot of these renditions of Malbec in the American market that are produced in a way that's like over extracted and like it stains your mouth and like really full bodied, but it's a really thin grape. Like the skins are really thin. So the fact that you're able to have like such a beautiful light rosé is because of the fact that the skins are so thin. It doesn't like, it imparts beautiful color, but it's also not the, it doesn't have the capability of producing a full bodied red. So I think the cool thing that when we're going to see through six different rendition, like six different locations of one variety, it'll give you the idea of what the bones are of this grape. So Chateau Femme, in my perspective, because I had tried his wines, Martin's wines, I was able to understand that variety a lot better than all of the Malbecs I had tried like through my younger palate, and larger producers. No, you're good. You're good. So,
I think that leads perfectly into our very first wine. We'll touch on what makes the Malbecs that Rachel's talking about, teeth staining and intense. We'll get to that shortly. But when we want to talk about beautiful Malbec and really ridiculously gorgeous looking Malbec, just take a look at that first one that's in your glass. It has this kind of crushed velvet curtains plushness to it. It looks like it could be maybe somebody's holiday Christmas type dress or anything. It's a really, really gorgeous wine. It comes from Manchuela in Spain, high up in the Pyrenees Mountains. We're talking about an elevation over 4,000 feet. So high altitude, the same way when we think about those Argentine Malbecs. There's the ones that come from the base of the hills, and then there's stuff that as you get to Catena Alta and everything else, climbs higher up the mountains. Rosalia Molina is the winemaker. Amazing, amazing, amazing story. Her and her husband acquired this property in the late 1980s, early 90s, and it used to be a giant co-op. And one of the things that happens a lot in Spain is they have more vines planted than anywhere else, but they also have a lot of abandoned vines. This used to be a co-op that was just kind of let go and nobody was using it anymore. And they slowly acquired a couple of parcels and then kept adding to it and adding to it. And every single time her husband, he's the viticulturist and she's the winemaker, he would go out and explore on the grounds. And he would come back and he would be incredibly excited because he'd be telling Rosalie, you're not going to believe it. I have this soil over here and then this soil over here. And then I found these grapes. He found 100-year-old Bobal vines, 100-year-old Petite Massang vines, 100-year-old Tempranillo vine. I mean, they've got a little bit of everything all over the place. And so one of my favorite things about this winery is if you ever get to go and visit, aside from the beautiful vistas, when you walk into their tasting room, they have this giant table, which would be the equivalent of putting the, you know, the six top and the four top together, maybe a little bigger, where they've done these 2 foot by 2 foot squares of all the different soils that they have around the property. So you can literally see every different soil and everything they have going on. She is incredibly talented. We had the first failed podcast was actually this great hour and a half conversation that Rachel, the winemaker, and I had all together it was so wonderful to hear them talk about the wines and talk about their project because it really is something new and different. This particular one is 50% in used oak and 50% in clay amphora, which is another reason why it has this beautiful color. And I'm going to take a moment to stop talking about it and swirl it and drink it, and I suggest you guys join me.
So just to clarify, because the list is in a different order, this is the... Okay.
Number one.
What's written on here is the order.
Go by the order of the glasses. Sure. Go ahead. It's a special time.
We'll ask for more.
We'll see what we can do. I have some great Sharpies, maybe some crayons from the kids' menus. Again, this is a... This is fun for me because it's Spanish Malbec, first of all.
Which is very atypical.
Yeah. This is not your normal Malbec in any way, shape, or form. For me, I get this great little briary fruit on the nose that normally I think when you think of Malbec, like Rachel was describing, you know, there's dark black fruits and there's usually an overabundance of American oak and vanilla and everything else that shows up on the nose. And this, again, used French oak and amphora. So what you're getting is the purity of the fruits. And it's really, really pretty.
Yeah, it's funny because the rule of thumb when you're evaluating wines, like blind tasting, for example, if it's an old world wine from Europe, earth drives the bus typically. And then if it's a new world wine, fruit drives the bus. So that's the first thing, like when you smell in the glass or you taste the wine, like that should be the initial thought process that you have. So like, you know, for example, like Bordeaux, like might be more barnyardy, and then like, you know, you have more like intense blackberry from the US. So it just depends on what your brain initially goes to. And in this case, like there is that earth drives the bus in terms of the floral component, like the lavender, the lilac. But at the same time, you do have a lot of that brambled fruit, and you have a lot of that like cranberry, pomegranate, like the which is also a lot of times when you have something in neutral oak and then in also amphora, the clay amphora, it tends to preserve more of that fruity and brighter characteristic than allowing it to round itself off into getting into those compounds that are a little bit darker. So,
what do you guys think?
Yeah, it's pretty delicious.
So this is true organic in every way, shape of the form and the meaning behind the rules of organic. So you've got your basic conventional farming, which is let's go ahead and whatever it takes to get a crop, we're going to do it. Chemicals, pesticides, fertilizers, whatever it is, that it's all being used. And generally when you've got that type of conventional farming, you're looking at a yield that is probably 10 tons of fruit per hectare or more is what they're really going for. Once you get into sustainable, organic, biodynamic farming and other variations on those, all those numbers drop significantly. And it also tends to align itself with when wines go from being something mass-produced to more artistic endeavors. You look at, for instance, almost the whole of Oregon, because they do a great job in getting this message out. Most Oregon wineries are going to be looking to get between 1.5 and 2.5 at the most tons per hectare out of their fruit. So again, we're talking a quarter or even an eighth of what a mass market winery is going to be doing, because that allows them to really drive for quality fruit, purity of flavors, and also uniqueness of flavors. With Rosalia, what she has done with organic, so it's a little funny because that high up, there's no bugs. They don't have to worry about bugs and pests and everything else. So immediately it gives them this head start where they don't have to do a lot of things that are going to really overextend the soil and rob it of a lot of things. And instead it becomes a question of what can we do to really make the soil as good as possible. So the wines then start to take on a life of their own. As Rachel will probably tell you, a majority of the work, if you really want to make great wine, is your time spent not in the lab, but it's in the vineyard. Mm-hmm. It's over and over just going.
It's like 70% of it. So, I mean, you can make a decent wine out of like bad fruit, but I mean, like you have to be a magician to do that.
and that's the thing. Once you adopt this organic philosophy, most of the organic producers are practicing organic, again, using not necessarily, you know, following biodynamic and everything else, which is super advanced, but organic means that we want to make sure that we are planting cover crops, are making sure that we have, you know, the proper yields, and making sure that the soil is alive and nutritious so that, again, we can hand this down off to the next generation and the next generation, the next generation. We're really making sure that what we're doing is setting a precedent. But it also means that by growing organically, you're going to be a little more flexible when it comes to making your wine. She plays around with a lot of wild yeast and spontaneous fermentation, which if you're not familiar with that, what it means is we're not using commercial yeast packet to start a fermentation, but we're gathering up the fruit, the flowers, the hay, and everything else that's around. And we're basically putting in this little carboid And we're starting a tea. So if you will, it's the wine version of a sourdough starter. And what it does is it captures everything, the essence of that vintage, everything that went on, all the weather, all the trials, all the tribulations, and everything else, all that shows up in your wine. And then that's the thing that allows you to make a wine that is the French terroir concept. You know, it's a uniqueness of place, it's a uniqueness of style. And it doesn't matter if somebody across the street is growing fruit, my wine is going to taste like it came from my area, my vineyards, and then I get to adapt my style to it. So that's, you know, one of the things that a lot of organic producers, and there's, again, regulations in becoming organic and being certified as organic. So there's a lot of varying opinions. We have a mutual friend whose vineyard is in his backyard of his house. So he's growing organically, but quote unquote, the hell if I'm going to pay anybody to tell me I'm growing organically because it's my backyard. So, you know, that's, he's
and it
Italian.
Costs more.
A little, yes.
Yeah.
It's about $4,000 per...
30 grand.
Yeah.
Well, for an American... So basically, if you grow organically in, let's say, another country, and there's a different license price for that. But then in order to get the little sticker that goes, or whatever that goes on your bottle to sell in the United States, it's a $30,000. So like, even if you're like farming very like earth sustainably, or if you're farming in a way that's more minimal and you could qualify for it, the price, like, that's why sometimes you see the price point to go, you know, go up a little bit. It's one thing for in other countries, but it's another thing for the United States, because, you know, I guess we're making money off of the fact that they're spending way more labor in the vineyard. But yeah, it's about $30,000. And it's a big turnoff for very small wineries. But the rule of thumb actually in Italy, for example, is that for like all wineries basically in Italy have to be like at the baseline sustainable. So they could all get that certification, but like you don't always see that because of the fact that, like, you know, who wants to spend that much money? I mean, you have to be a large producer to do that.
Four months in oak, and then about 6 months, they'll age for 4 to 6 months in oak. And they'll age in the amphoras again for 4 to 6 months, combine that back into tank, and then bottle that, and it'll sit in the bottle for 6 months until they release it. To me, this is one of those things of why I'm in the wine industry. You give me something that's easily identifiable as Malbec, but you take it in a direction that it doesn't taste like most Malbecs. And really, the first time I tried that, I said, this is so cool. Because I can't tell you another Malbec that I had that tastes like this. And that's that check the box. Sure. So the question, and this is a nice little segue. So the question, if you didn't hear, was I like Malbec, but I feel it tends to be a little bit of a cheaper, less expensive wine. No, everybody loves good, cheap wine. I always tell everybody, your problem as a wine drinker is when you start to like expensive bottles of wine, because once you hit that plateau, you don't go back usually. You know, for me,
I have.
God bless. For me, I remember the first bottle of wine that I ever fell in love with was a $4.99 bottle of Montepulciano from Italy, which the guy said, if you want to buy a case, I'll give it to you for $3.99. And I was like, this is awesome. You've been doing that. You know, and those were the great days. And I still love those inexpensive little wines when you find them, but it's becoming harder and harder to find them because, you know, in certain instances, it's almost more expensive for the stuff to package and bottle and sell your wine than it is to actually put the wine in the bottle. So, you know, what you run into, though, when we're talking about a lot of inexpensive Malbecs is part of the reason why we wanted to do this tasting. There is a thing. Anybody heard of Mega Purple before?
It's my favorite thing to talk about.
Wait a minute. Let's pour wine number two in your glass if you haven't done so already, because you're going to want a little drink.
I don't think there's any Mega Purple today.
No.
At least it's not for mine. So,
wine number two is Chateau Le Ricardel. It is a side project from actually funny, when you were working for Siema, you might recognize this. Coupe Frontet was that little winery that we had those guys from Virginia that came in for a while.
Château Franc Couplet.
Was that
Jim?
Oh, was that no? I know that I know Jim, but was that
Black and White Label? Tall, three quarters of the way up on the bottle.
Did they have a Petit Verdot too? Was that that was Homme Chevalier?
That was Homme Chevalier. Yeah, same portfolio but different. Yeah. Anyways, Château Franc Couplet is this great Bordeaux property, and in 2014 they expanded and they were able to buy this particular property, vineyard, and winery. And it was because what we see in the world today is your historic sources and locations for wine are experiencing climate change, and they are up against the wall because what they've done for centuries, they can't do anymore. So radical changes are coming to your wines, especially in France, where they've had since 1855 most of their set rules about what grapes should be grown where and how you should make wine and all the recipes and techniques.
When to harvest.
It's a big deal. And now all of that, they're looking at saying, you know, we can't do it. We're not getting the same conditions that we used to have before. All of Germany rewrote their entire wine laws. Their hundreds and hundreds of year old consistent wine laws were rewritten 5 years ago because it has been 20 plus years since they were able to get a traditional German harvest with natural ripening sugar levels. And the old German wine rules were written of everything has to be natural, no chapelization, no acidification of your wines at all. And so you started out with your early harvest wines when your acid was higher and your sugars were low. And those were your cabinets. And then you moved to Spätlese, Ostlese, then your Trockenbeeren Ostlese, and onward. It has been 20 plus years since they've been able to get natural cabinet. It just doesn't happen anymore because it's so hard to harvest it with the heat that we have. So France has changed their rules. And where it used to be in Bordeaux, there were five blending grapes, and it was almost always going to be predominantly Cab Franc or Merlot. That was your base grape. And then throwing in Cabernet Sauvignon, Malbec, and Petit Verdot. What you have in your glass right now is 100% Malbec from Bordeaux, and it's labeled as Bordeaux. So this is a sea change that we don't normally see, and something totally different, which...
It's beautiful.
And it's also mega purple free.
Yeah. Well, the French wouldn't do that. I know them too well. Yeah, no, this is beautiful. You do get a lot of that smoky, like chocolatey instance in the first part of the nose. It dissipates really nicely on the palate. This is actually when I first started trying wine professionally, when I was tasting wine professionally,
unofficially,
I was quite young. I was not of legal age. But
we found out the statute of limitations is over. She can admit this now.
Yeah. But I was tasting wine professionally, and I was actually, it was about 2010 when I started tasting wine in a manner that was more serious. I really enjoyed Malbec as a variety because I could pinpoint it in a blind tasting. Like this, I could pinpoint in a blind tasting because it tastes like Malbec to me. And then there was a vintage, which is the whole mega purple thing, that there was a vintage where I felt like, for example, Argentina was,
that's Gironde, whatever.
Oh yeah. Okay. So there was a period of time after like the 2007, 2008 vintage of Napa, which we all like probably remember that is like one of the top vintages of all time, quote unquote, because like they were trying to mimic the high intensity fruit and full bodiedness that wines were in Napa from Argentina. So all of a sudden, like within the next couple of years, you started seeing Malbec as like the inkiest wine ever. And not saying that all Argentinian Malbecs are like this. I'm sure that most of them are not, but like the mass produced ones definitely most likely are. And it stains your mouth. And Mega Purple is a great concentrate that you can use to deepen the color, also help with the mouthfeel. And it's grape concentrate. So it's not like you're adding sugar.
It's considered a natural product, yeah. Although it's not natural winemaking.
Yeah.
Start with that.
Yeah. So it is in my perspective, but yeah, I mean, most wines you should be able to see through the glass. Malbec is thin skinned. You should be able to see through it.
You had a question.
Yeah.
That's a great question. I want to say this is 2020, but let me make sure that it's not 19.
That's young for 2020. It tastes young.
Yep, 2020 on the Rica Day. And then we are... We are blind. Hold on. 2019 on the Mille Historias. And while we're at it, the Bedell is going to be 2020. The Agua de Pietra is going to be 2022. The Famé is going to be 2020. And the Low Vineyards
22
is 22. And we'll talk about that in a second. So back to the original question. So when you were asking how come Malbec can be so inexpensive, it's directly tied into that whole concept of mega purple. Because here, if we're growing 10 tons of fruit, we're probably mechanical harvesting, and we're literally, we're not waiting to say, well, that vineyard is done and that row is done. And that's, no, we're harvesting everything that we can, everything. And it doesn't matter if the grapes are ripe, underripe, overripe, or whatever. We reach a certain sugar level for a majority of the grapes, and we say, go. And that's it. And then the big collectors come down and they pull everything off, ripe or unripe. And then what happens is, in order to get balance out of that, you're doing the work in the lab. You didn't do the work in the vineyard. You didn't sit there and wait. You're not hand harvesting. You're trying to just get as much as we can. So how do we balance out super high acidity and abrasiveness with over sugar over here? Mega purple is your answer, because it's that thing that now covers everything and creates, again, a more established baseline of flavor. Which, again, as much as we have some personal issues with Mega Purple, it's not to say that these aren't delicious wines and some of them aren't great. The trend happened that everybody chased Robert Parker. Parker loved the big, in-your-face, just punch me to death, super stainy, super inky, super intense wines. And so even if you couldn't duplicate that, if you got a shade of it or a shadow of it, it was good enough to say, I like this wine. And so it's that thing that happened. And you look at the volatility of the Argentinian economy, where, you know, we were dealing with it as importers, where we would make a deal for a container, and then 2 days later we found out that the container, somebody else just offered to pay twice as much for it. So we lost our wine. And so that's where we backed away from a lot of Argentinian wines in the import business. Not because we didn't like them, just because it was crazy. You were having to buy 3 and 4 containers at a time, pay cash up front, because otherwise you weren't going to get the wine. And we just said, we don't even know if we like the vintage or not yet. So we weren't gonna commit to it. So God bless everybody who stayed with it, because there are some beautiful, beautiful Argentinian Malbecs that are out there, and you are finding some great buys. But what we wanted to present tonight is, let's show you different sides of Malbec, because I don't think there's a palate in the room that thinks the first and the second wine taste the same. Is there? Anybody?
So what are you saying?
I'm not saying that it's past in any way, shape, or form. Those wines are still out there, but what we've seen is the pendulum swing to everybody saying, look, if everybody's Malbec tastes exactly the same, why am I buying yours? People stopped buying based on the name, and they bought on the price. That's what it is. It became that thing that I want to pay $10.99 for a Malbec. I want to pay $24.99 for a Malbec. I want to pay $100 for a Malbec. And so that's what they were looking for. It was, I want, you know, this price point and maybe a certain flavor style that I'm pretty sure I'm going to get. It's just a question of how much the volume was turned up on that super extracted, heavy, heavy, heavy concentrated wine. And so you see people in Argentina like the Zuccardi family. One of the biggest families down there, and their winery has said, look, we've always been really in competition with Catena and with Luigi Basco, and everybody was chasing those high Parker scores. And so what do we do that's different? Because the pendulum, when you were first pushing it, was going to more alcohol, more intensity, more concentration, newer oak, more new American oak, not new French oak. And then you had people like Donald Hess that came by and, you know, started to build a mega winery down there doing that and putting California style and Argentinian together. So, you know, there's only so big that you can get before everybody says, I'm palate fatigued because everything tastes the same. So Zuccardi came back and started doing all concrete fermentation on their Malbec to make it stand out.
which is really cool. They still do their regular one, but they said, let's show off a different side of it. So I again, I'm not poo-pooing. I'm just applauding everybody who says, let's do something different with a grape.
I think that when you get to any wine, it's not just Malbec, but I think when you get to any level of production size, you're going to find an issue along the lines of something similar. And I think that Malbec is a classic example because it filled the hole of where people stopped drinking Merlot. And because of that, I think that there's a lot of that, there's a lot of the explosion from Argentina, and then you see a decline of California Merlot, and so they wanted to be able to bring the sugar up somewhere. But again, yeah, it's mostly with the mass production. When you see wines that are not, you know, the orientation of the vineyard is not like in every single liquor store, then you're probably better off in choosing it. Whether or not it's $10 or $50, I think that it just really depends on the production size and just looking up the winery and seeing, like, do they make 1 million bottles? Do they make 5 million bottles? Or do they make 20,000 bottles? So that gives you a better idea, I think.
But I also will bring it back to this particular wine. They're located in Gironde, north of Entre-deux-Mer, you know, in the eastern part of the Bordeaux region. Again, which was usually super lean, super angular wines that were a lot more precision wines rather than really giving you a lot of fruit. I love the change in fruit from our first wine, which had that little bramminess and freshness to instantly. There's spice, there's savoriness in this wine that I think is a really, really attractive quality because, again, you know, we're not covering up with just, you know, one note of American vanilla Missouri oak. You know, you're getting to taste a lot of what makes the soil in this area really special and really fun.
It's really beautiful. I mean, it's a very classic example of French Malbec. And I think classic in a way that, I mean, you could hold on to this wine for 5-10 years at least. Yep. Because it has that earthy character in the front, and then it also has a little tightness. So even though it's 4 years old, it still has plenty of life left. And I think that that's a unique aspect because a lot of times when we do see Malbec in the market and in a store, typically when people buy it, it's not something that you're going to think of as like aging for a long period of time. You're going to buy it, you're going to drink it within that week. But this one is a wine that you could hold on to if you wanted to.
The public is starting to find out about this. Wine enthusiasts, we just found out a few weeks ago, rated this 91 points. And we're just impressed because of the fact that, again, we're talking about straight Malbec, not anything that's being backed up by Cabernet or Merlot or anything else. So we really are, we're really excited about this. Which leads us into the next one. I grew up in New York. I grew up and went to school in the Finger Lakes, and so I was very much New York State wine proud and developed this little bit of a bias because everybody wanted to talk about, oh, Long Island is the best area for growing wine in New York. And I'm sitting here going, no, the Finger Lakes is great. But they were basically, you know, they might have been two different worlds because what you were looking at in the Finger Lakes was a lot of concentration on your Alsace styles, your Rieslings, your Gewurztraminers, and a lot of the Cornell Cooperative Extension hybrid grapes that they would put out there and some of the French hybrid grapes. Then you go down to Long Island and they were really trying to push more traditional Bordeaux varietals, a lot more French heavy influence in that. And a lot of that was just a response to being that proximity to New York and to having those vacationers, you know, from Montauk and Block Island and Boston and everywhere else that came out there. So Bedell was one of the first people to plant Merlot the United States. I believe they're getting close to, if it wasn't the last year, their 50th anniversary as far as harvest of
really?
Of Merlot. Yeah. I want to say it was 45 a couple of years ago. It was 30 back when you were with us. 35.
I haven't been really?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. So Bedell is this old school winery, and they had a really great winemaking team. And then a few years ago, they decided to break and go sustainable or practicing organic, not necessarily all certified organic yet. And they started to embrace a lot of alternative varietals. They they really made their name at first with making Merlot and then doing a white blend and a red blend and a rosé blend that were basically their Montauk and Hamptons wines that everybody had. And then they started to embrace other varietals, doing alternative versions of white grapes, planting Albarino, and really said, look, if we're a cool climate growing area, let's lean into this. And what can we do with these grapes in a cool climate? And so what you're about to see here is your first real, true, cool climate Malbec that we get to try. And again, it is vastly different than everything else. So if you haven't already, oh yeah.
Do you want to talk about the one of the owners of Padel?
In which part? Andrew or new or prior?
Michael Lynn.
Oh, gosh. No. I want to talk about how perfumey and aromatic this one is. So the first wine I thought was very, very fruity. The second one had a lot more savoriness. This one we're starting to get into very, very aromatically perfumed. And also a little bit of that underlying sweetness. I'm not going to say it's that candied Laffy Taffy perfuminess, but there is a little tanginess to it.
Yeah, it has a rounder mouthfeel than the Bordeaux. And they do a totally different style of like fermentation. They use it's chitin, right? They use what is the foot shells? Are they
the?
It's not crab shell. It's oyster shells.
Yes.
Yeah, oyster shells.
So again, with this one, I'm 100% Malbec, no blending at all, using the spontaneous wild fermentation, the wild yeast, that tea method we have. It's really funny. The first time we did a Zoom call with the winemaker, he was so excited because he had just put together a new batch of the tea. So he's literally bringing his laptop and his iPad over so you could see it, and you're watching it. As it's sitting there, it's bubbling away, and again, he's like, look, there's these flowers, and there's this hay, and then we got this, and I got some apples, and we got some pears, we threw in some cherries there, too, and it's wild to hear him talk about it, because this is their little baby that they're cultivating every year, and it is, if you're a beer fan or a brewer, you know, brewers are super, super protective of their native yeast strains that they're using, because that's the backbone, the spice, the flavor of their beer. So it's not surprising that winemakers have looked at this and adapted that as well. If I can control my yeast, I can do some really fun things. And I'll make sure I pass around. I've got a picture of the tea that we'll pass around so everybody can see that.
We'll pass it around now. Yeah.
Start fresh every year. A majority of the times, I'm not going to say it's 100% fresh every year. They'll usually have a little bit, not in the same way of a sourdough starter, but most people are looking to have that in reserve just in case something goes wrong. But their main goal is to start brand new yeast every single year again. But also truer, because if your grapes should be responding and your fermentation should be responding to those yeasts that are already there. So we're really just amplifying everything that you have going on in the vineyard. And I think you get that freshness, that yeastiness, that really beautiful nose on this wine. Again, they're moving towards being an all gravity fed winery, so that they're trying to be as low manipulation to the wines as they possibly can, which allows the preservation of a lot of those aromatics to really stand out and show up in your glass. For me, this is the first wine also that I'm starting to see a little more of that purple effect. The other ones were, you know, variations on red velvet. I think this is the first one that we're starting to look into a little bit a darker aspect as far as the color of the wine goes, showing up a little of the blues and the purples.
Yeah, a lot of times when you have a the way that you make red wine is that basically you have the fruit, you crush it, you de-stem it, and then the longer that the skins and the juice and the seeds all sit together in a tank, the darker the color theoretically. In this case, it's been interesting because like the first one was quite lighter. And again, that kind of goes with that whole aspect that like Malbec is a very thin skin grape. Then the second one to me was actually almost darker. Well, close to the third one, but the third one is more vibrant. The Bedel is a little bit more vibrant. And then when it sits on your tongue, it kind of goes like this. Like it kind of opens up a little bit different than the Bordeaux does. And that to me is sometimes more of an indication of the fact that because it's a little bit plumper, it might be more new world in that sense, because it doesn't have the full fruit. So it probably on the North Fork of Long Island, because they're on the water, essentially, they do sometimes even get a little bit of their reds and their whites. Their whites actually even more so get a lot of minerality because of that salt breeze that comes in. The red in this case, you get a little bit of the minerality in the front, but you get the plumpness in the back, which kind of gives you the full, like, it's like first course to like third course all in like one sip. But Bedel is really a leader in the New York, especially the Long Island wine scene. And it's very interesting to see how Long Island has really grown as an industry. For wine, and it's more than just like you can have a wedding there for $25,000 at like baseline. It's also the fact that the wines are really Bedel like 10 years ago was $25,000 for having a wedding there with no other added like fees, like didn't include the wine, just included the venue. But now who knows what it is now, but the aspect is more so that it's become a really elevated wine area. So,
and again, what they're really doing when they're going to these unique grapes like Melon de Bourgogne and Pinot Gris and Albarino and everything else is they're saying, look, we're not trying to force anything anymore. We're really relying on saying, look, we have this growing season. We know we have this massive amount of humidity over here. We know we're cooler climate. What can we get the best out of all those? So again, they're trying to be a zero manipulation. They're not adding any acids or any sugars or anything else. They are really tirelessly working hard in the vineyards to make the best grapes that they possibly can. And then again, really trying to capture what makes it special. So if in you know this particular year, what you had these late rains, which could have been a little devastating to your harvest. So they made sure they got out into the vineyards and picked a little bit early. So that's why also you have a little more brightness to this wine from that early picking. Not that it was unripe, but it was just earlier. So instead of waiting to get saturated, they said, look, we can make something that's got this fresher aspect to it, and that'll really translate well to the glass.
The one thing I will say about global warming on the East Coast of the United States, like it's very different to have global warming. Not, I shouldn't do this, but global warming in general in Europe. There's been a lot of issues with frost and with, you know, the fact that like they have very strict regulations of when you can harvest and all those different things. And in the East Coast of the United States, besides the hurricane aspect, because like hurricanes obviously are detrimental and will ruin a whole entire yield. But beyond that, climate change has actually been very beneficial for East Coast wineries. Who knows if that's going to remain that way? I really kind of hope that it just stays the way it is. It doesn't get any different. I don't want anything else like to go extreme. But it's really allowed a lot of the wineries on the East Coast to have really great ripening for our reds. You know, 20, 30 years ago, I mean, my family's winery's been around for 42 years. 30 years ago, it was not possible really to make a red wine to the caliber that we can make today. And that goes along with New York. It goes along with Pennsylvania. It goes along with really most places on the East Coast because of the fact that the way that the climate was, and also education and learning of how to grow grapes according to the climate was a little bit different. But now we can grow Malbec when like 15 years ago, we couldn't, we actually couldn't. I mean, 15 years ago, we had still really cold winters and to some extent compared to now, because like, I mean, we're lucky if we see like a flurry. But
they'll still cancel school, don't we?
They still cancel school, but like my dog is not very happy with it. He likes to run around and pounce in the snow, but it's something that's really interesting because anyone, like people who would plant Malbec, people would think that they're crazy because you would lose your vines in the winter because it's not a cold hardy variety. Now it's like, it's thriving and it's getting really good sugars. It's getting like the acids are really perfect. And on a bad year, you're still making decent Malbec. So that's a really interesting thing to think about. This variety was not necessarily the most adaptable, but the climate has adapted to be able to make it better. Not always in the most positive way because climate change is not good and like all those things are not good, but it has been beneficial for the East Coast. So, yeah.
It's served you well with the
spotlight. Yes, 100%. But not necessarily France. Yeah, so.
Trade-offs.
Yeah.
You're going to have to start learning to think that Great Wall from China is a delicious wine.
Yeah.
That's another story.
I don't know.
Okay, so we come to the halfway point, and at this point in time, we thought it wouldn't be a class and a tasting and a podcast about Malbec if we didn't go right to the source. This is a wine that, I'll be honest, my liver adores in every way, shape, and form. This is the wine that made me say, with all the craziness that was going on with Argentinian wine market and everything else, I don't care. If you give me nothing but this exact Malbec for the rest of my life and you say this is the only Malbec that you can get to have, I am totally fine because to me, this is textbook perfect Malbec. This is everything that thumbed in the face of all the Bordeaux people that said Malbec can never be a star on its own. This is everything that everybody from Cahors loves, and this is everything that drove everybody from Cahors mad when everybody started to claim that Malbec was an Argentinian grape. They said, don't you know what it should taste like? It should taste like exactly what's in your glass right now.
Yeah.
So before we go on, pour this wine in your glass. This is the Chateau Femme Prestige. Cuvée Prestige is absolutely delicious. Everybody have a drink, and then we'll talk about it.
Reminds me of mine, actually. Mm-hmm. I was like, whoa. It's like, I forgot how much I really went after. I copied him. Yeah. Next time he comes into town, I want to hang out with him.
We'll do a thing.
Yeah.
My dream is, can you imagine getting Martin and Kim in town at the same time?
I haven't seen him since I went around with him in Baltimore and I gave him a bottle of my wine and he sent me a message. It was so that must have been, I think it's 2017, 2016.
But we'll talk afterwards. He might be coming back this spring. So I'm hearing a lot of rumbles and a lot of oohs and ahs. And the thing that my ears keep picking up more than everything else is everybody's talking about this wine kind of leaping out of the glass. There's a little more pungency. There's a lot more spice. There's a heavier, headier alcohol note that's coming to me. Am I hitting about everything that everybody found, or is there anything else anybody would like to?
You didn't say yummy.
Ah, we'll get to that. I thought professing my liver's undying love for this wine might have covered yummy, but yes, it definitely is yummy. Starting right away, just from the color, Martin. So a backstory. Let's rewind a little bit. Martin and his dad came down to Quercy, from Belgium, and originally first started a winery in Loire, and then realized very quickly, you know, Loire is not necessarily my favorite style of wine, and these aren't the wines that I enjoy. And so after 2 short years, they sold that, packed that up, and went looking for a new property. And it was there, traveling around France, that they found this great little farm in the Lot Valley, close to the Lot River, in the heart of Cahors in Malbec country, and said, this is the place. And ever since then, they have gone full bore in everything about the region, the food, the culture. They are there. They have absorbed it and they have reflected it. They are practicing organic. They have received a level 3 award for environmental consciousness and sustainability in the practices. Martin can make anything. He made that beautiful rosé bonus wine that we had. For those of you who got here really early, you got to see what he does with Pet Nat, a crazy, crazy technique that some people master and other people shouldn't. He makes his own bread. He built a pizza oven. He makes his own pizzas. He brews beer. He's a whiskey fan, so he started distilling also. He can do just about anything. And when it comes to making wine, I love it because he is so precise and scientific. He will not make anything unless he knows he's going to be able to make it good. He will research it. He will practice. He will do everything. He will try all the different techniques till he finds out what is going to make that wine perfect. And then at that point in time, it goes into production, and then we finally get to drink it. So in all the years that I've had this wine, I have never, ever, ever had a bottle that has disappointed me. And now the critics and everybody else are starting to notice. He just got another round of amazing awards from both wine enthusiasts. And for the second year in a row, Decanter Magazine named his Cuvée X, the one step up from this, as one of their favorite 100 wines of the year, giving another platinum award. 97 points last year, 96 points this year. So pretty darn consistent. But what we're dealing with here is Martin saying, okay, I'm going to make a wine close to the river, which is his Chevalier de Femme Côte de Lotte. It is a stainless steel Malbec that is very fresh, very easy to drink. It's his house wine.
Yeah.
Then when we go to the second cut, as we start to get a little elevation, that's where this comes from. So we've got a little more drainage, a little more stress on the vine. So we're creating better, more intense fruit with a lot more character to it. But he doesn't want to overpower that character. So this sees anywhere from 14 to 24 months in used oak, always second, third, or fourth fill barrels. So we're not going for something that is going to powerhouse this to death with all sorts of nuances of oak. Instead, it's got to be a little bit of oak. And he's pretty close to about, you know, 30% of each of those second, third, and fourth fill when he's doing it. You'll notice the color is a little deeper. He's fermenting for 21 days in concrete fermenters before he's been having fun.
Expensive. I like those.
He's crafting something that's beautiful. And, you know, it's really one of those wines that I think stops you in your tracks when you want to talk about Malbec. This is perfect. It'd be really great if you had like a steak with it, or maybe an aged steak from a really good butcher.
Anybody we know?
This producer is what changed my perspective on Malbec. So I used to work with Nick. I was I also worked as a distributor with Siema, like in between working with my grandparents full time and after college. And there was a period where like I was kind of thrown onto working with Martin for a couple of days, working in the market. And I was not the most thrilled before I had tried his wines to work with Malbec for like a couple of days straight. But then once I tried the wines and I met him, I was really surprised in the sense that it changed my perspective on Malbec as a variety. And I thought, okay, but I only like his. I only like his Malbec. I don't like anybody else's. But of course, my opinions changed a little bit. I like his and others too. I didn't pigeonhole myself. But his was the first that really gave me the idea to how to treat the variety, because it felt like it reminded me of what the expression was of Malbec from Argentina, specifically from the years prior before it got large. And in this case, the nice thing about knowing France is that there are, even though there aren't necessarily the most, like, they have a lot of like regulations and commissions that you have to stay within certain realms to an extent. I mean, you can do other fun things too, but the way that I see they follow more of they respect the tradition and how the wine is supposed to be treated. The grape is supposed to be treated. They respect the variety. Not saying that Argentina does. It's a very different climate, but I do think that in this case, I've really enjoyed seeing his wines evolve over the years and all the different renditions that he's had. And every sommelier that I've shown them, I used to show these wines to, they're like, oh yeah, this is true Malbec. this is what this variety is supposed to taste like. And it's true. I mean, I taste it. I totally feel that way.
You're dealing with soils that are very, a lot of sand and gravel and clay and pebbles. So again, you've got some really good drainage in the soils. It's not necessarily super rich soils, which again, your grapes actually like this because it forces them to dig deeper to find the water source. And in this case, again, the river's not that far away, but the vines are going down, so they become self-sustaining. And again, they develop a lot of character and a lot of intensity. And it's really with this gravelly soil that I think this is a sea change as far as the soil from the other wines that we've had. This is the first time that we've really had that kind of pebble gravel combination. And it's going to lead into what we get to next as we move into Argentina. So is there anybody has any questions about Mautin's fabulous Cuvée Prestige before we jump to Argentina?
How much of this did you bring with you?
Yeah. We got enough. So the difference between this and Cuvée X is simply the use of new oak. Cuvée X is exclusively done in brand new French oak. So it is a more modern style, a little more powerhouse, more intense in every way, shape, and form. Still pretty darn tasty, though.
Yeah.
But it is that nod towards how do we make something that is very rich and very concentrated without falling into gloop, you know, where you've got something that doesn't have character.
Yeah, the X is like, from what I remember it, it was just like. Like the big brother of it in that sense.
He also does one that's called Cuvée S, his Sans Sulfite, which is done in eggs instead of barrels, which egg-shaped barrels, conical fermenters. So that, again, they are, it's a self-turning process. It's funny, when I taste Martin's Cuvée S, it's very much in the vein of what you had from the Bedell, where there's a lot of freshness and a lot of brightness to it. But again, he's having fun. He's playing. Speaking of playing, Agua de Pietra from the foothills of the Andes. This is a wine that for the longest time, when we want to talk about inexpensive Malbec that brings you lots of joy, this is one of those ones for me. I had a tough time because I said I want to show off something from Argentina. And again, Luigi Bosco and Catena kind of have the Pepsi-Coke relationship responsible for about, you know, 65% of the market down in Argentina. The Zuccardi family has been around for a long time too, and they make many, many different versions. Catena has basically influenced almost everybody, has some connection and tie to them. You definitely, if you're in the wine industry, have a tie to one of those three families. You look at Susanna Balbo, and you look at Catena's daughter with her line from Luca and Tikal. They get it. They know what they're doing, and they came from a position where they had a lot of great resources, and they threw them into making some of the most beautiful and architecturally stunning wineries around, and they're all high altitude in the mountains. But again, I think there are some things where you have to watch out for where you can get lost in something that doesn't have any distinctiveness or character. What I love about this one is I think it taps into the beginning of those kind of cigar box and tobacco and smoke aspects in the wine. Still bringing a little richness.
Boysenberry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're in Luján del Cuyo is the area where this is from.
Hmm. The nice thing with this one is it has a round mouthfeel, but it's not like, it doesn't have that like super sweet characteristic. And that's like one of the biggest indicators in Mac Purple. If it's like overly sweet on the palate and it kind of just goes like this and it just stops there. But this one, it really doesn't do that. It has similar characteristics as the Famé in the sense of it has the same body type. It has a little bit different of that earthy versus fruity. This one's a little bit more fruit forward. And, but it's very pleasant. It's really pleasant.
But I think this is where, if you're like me, great fruit up front, you know, our Venn diagram, we have that fruit and that alcohol, and then here come the tannins. And this tannic presence, that's American oak. That's the first time we've really seen American oak in our tasting today.
Yeah.
And this is what American oak does. It gives you this pronounced dryness, that little dusty aspect. I don't know about you guys, but my tongue is completely bone dry, devoid of moisture right now. And this wine has come at it and been like, wake up, I'm here for you.
The one thing to think about also when you think of different oak, when you're getting different flavors. So when you have American oak, for example, American oak is a very loose grain. So like you can taste the fact that it's going to impart a lot of flavor very quickly. And it's going to do what a French oak barrel will do in, let's say, 18 months. You can get like in 6 months from American oak. They're cheaper also, but like not my favorite personally. But it does give you the indication of like all of that flavor up front. A little bit of that vanilla, a little bit of that like milk chocolatey kind of characteristic, and the fennel and any minty notes for the most part. But the French oak is really more streamlined. It's more like espresso. If you were to have hot chocolate versus espresso and like some more concentrated flavors, typically you see that in French oak. But
yeah, definitely that cocoa finish.
Yeah,
100% cocoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, pairing wise, there's just no doubt. There's two things in my mind: beef, chocolate.
Yeah.
Big fudgy brownie, and this is such a decadent, happy thing in my world. Lamb would be nice. Depends on the level of mint and everything else.
Yeah,
how you season it.
Yeah.
But again, give me like Rachel said, if you have something with a little bit of gaminess to it, something that can stand up to that intensity of the American oak there. That would be a really nice pair for it, or a foil, I should say. But yeah, rich, chocolate, fudgy, brownie sundae with this. Yeah, go for it. If you're not a fan of dessert wines, go ahead and have this for dessert instead. All right, so what do y'all think?
Like the tannins.
Yeah.
Wake you up, tannins. I'm here, I'm your wine. I'll be with you for the rest of your night.
It's a 14.
Yeah, this should be 14.6, 14.8, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood. Okay, so that brings me to my favorite point in this wine tasting. The point where we wreck everybody's minds and preconceived notions and tastes and taste buds and leave you going, what? And not what the hell, but what? For those of you that aren't familiar, Rachel is the current winemaker at her family-owned winery right up in Mount Airy, Maryland. So just up the road, a quick little jaunt. And what's the general opinion for you guys on local wines? Let's start there. I mean exactly that. Either one.
Drinkable.
So we'll do that at our Black Ankle and Six Glasses class. How about that for my political answer? Actually, I can touch on that a little bit. So I think what happens and what you're seeing right here in that response is really good. You've got this perception from a lot of people that it's local wine. You know, maybe it's not your first choice, but you want to go out for a weekend, go to the vineyard, go have fun. Okay, well, great. It's time passer. But when you go to the store, your wallet and your credit card receipts say different as far as your fandom for local wines. It's good for an experience, but it's not the thing that you go reach out and buy on the shelf. And I think sometimes that's an economic factor. You know, yeah, not a lot of the local wines. If they're $85, it's certainly not a $10 bottle of wine, and it's certainly not maybe a Monday or Tuesday wine. Doc?
If we go back to the American and the French, I forget the name of the film, California wines prove themselves. I think what has happened with people like Rachel and the business of wine masters, the science has caught up with them. So my ex-partner, his father-in-law, has a vineyard over in Virginia, and the Virginia wines are nice, and Rachel's wine I enjoy. So times have changed because of the science of winemaking.
I'm gonna say as Rachel already pointed out, climate, absolutely. Science, yes, learning a little bit more about it. And it comes from learning about the region and what we can grow here instead of trying to force the issue, trying to say, if everybody wants cab, I'm going to grow cab. If everybody wants sideways now and not Merlot, I'm going to grow Pinot Noir. And instead of just forcing the square peg in the round hole, we're actually saying, well, what can I grow here? And you look at the folks at Black Ankle, they were some of the first people to go off and do really extensive climate and soil testing to figure out what varieties grow in the same type of soil and the same type of weather that we have here. And they looked all over the world for that and matched it up. And that's how they planted Gruner, Veltliner, and Albarino. In addition to still trying to do the Bordeaux varietals and everything else, they said, we're going to do other things that would fit here. And you're starting to see people embrace things like Zweigelt and Black Frankish and other cool climate grapes. But what happens is when we go off, we're still thinking, I have it in my head, I want a Malbec, I'm going to go and I'm going to go grab my little $10 bottle of Argentina. And that's fine. But here's the thing. I want to ask you why. Because if we're actually just sitting here and we're going to debate on taste and flavor and quality and how well the wine is made, welcome to your newest favorite wine.
So, you know, it's interesting. We all have different business models. I think that that's something that when I was growing up in the industry, my grandparents, I'm a fifth generation when it comes to winemaking and third generation in terms of the United States. There's a difference, I think, between the wineries that started in the 2010s and the ones who started in the 80s. You know, you have the generational aspect. Black Ankles, they're very good friends of mine. And like, we're all very good friends. Like, we think that if one of us do well, we all do well. And I think in many aspects that like their business model has really worked for them. I mean, like, honestly, I wish I could have their business model. Like, beyond the whole, like, we wouldn't be charging $85 for a tasting. I don't think that that's something that my family would ever, like, my grandfather would haunt me forever, because he would then say, like, how much do you really want to eat? But at the same time, like, they have their own really fantastic business model that has worked for them, and their wine club has a wait list. I wish I had that. But I will say that what something's really interesting, over the past, because of Black Ankle, we've been in an industry that has in Maryland that was elevated. So when one of us do well, we all do well. And because of them, we have started to be, they kind of were the catalyst of reintroducing the dry wines that we all loved to produce. There was a period of time in the early 90s, the beginning of the 2000s, where just before that, my grandfather, my grandmother, like my family were making probably 80% of our wines were dry. But they weren't selling. Because if you think about the area that we were surrounded by in Mount Airy, and it was actually, like, there's a monastery down the street. They like a lot of sweet wines. And even Linganore had the same problem. They wanted to produce dry wines only. Okay, so the idea was we had to produce what was actually going to sell. And then all of a sudden, we're producing these sweet wines, and you're seeing it at a festival, and that's the only form of marketing that we had in, like, the 80s and the 90s. And because of that, Maryland was known as a sweet wine state. We had to produce wines for the festivals. We call them festival wines, okay? And we didn't like to produce them, to be honest. About like four, yeah, my friend Melissa from like the next generation of Linganore, she's a very dear friend of mine. She goes, look, Chateau Cashflow. Like, seriously. They funded, those sweet wines funded the ability of making the high-end dry wines. And that was so important to us, actually. I mean, festivals at one point in time, back in when I was growing up, I was going in strollers to test the festivals. They actually count about for 30% of our sales. For four weekends a year, we could account for 30% of our sales. My grandparents had to go back and bottle more strawberry wine on a Saturday evening to be able to have it for Sunday, when they would still sell out and call me Britney Spears because I was 12 years old and like apparently looked like that. I did not. Same color hair, because these people wanted me to sell them strawberry. I'm like, I can't legally do that. I'm sorry. But anyway, that's the idea of how this industry kind of got to where it was. And then it was Black Ankle and a couple other producers that really put Maryland on the map. in that sense of being able to, wait, we can produce dry wines and they can be expensive. Now, I will say my wines are not $85 a bottle. I have one wine that's $54 a bottle, but like it's what it gave us the idea of we can actually produce a wine and not like lose money on it. Because labor is also extremely expensive. I mean, the amount of the cost of fruit in the state of Maryland is borderline more expensive, almost double the price than you would buy fruit in California. So it's because, and honestly, in my perspective personally, because you already hear what I've thought about with Argentina, I could go on for days about California too, mass production. You're getting a higher, and people ask me all the time, well, why aren't you buying fruit or grape or juice from California and making your wines because it's better there? Like, it's not. The ones that, the juice that you're selling is also heavily involved with smoke taint because of the wildfires, and that's a whole other situation. So anyway, I honestly could go on for days about this.
Well, we'll put a pin in it really simply.
Yeah, thank you.
Most of the time, the fruit that you're going to sell is the fruit that you didn't want to make wine out of. Or it's the fruit that you have a glut of that nobody else would buy. And that's why that exists.
Yeah.
What we have in Maryland, you know, we have a very short and complex growing season. And so everybody really is looking not only for, again, their estate fruit if they have it, but high quality fruit.
Yeah.
And where can I get it? And then the problems with, did it rain? When did it start raining? What happened to the fruit? Because it's almost always a race against the rain and the thunderstorms to get it in. And so then what you have is, I was going to get X number of tons of fruit. I got some of it, then the rains hit, and now I don't want this fruit, or I can't have this fruit, or I can't make the same wine with this. So we're in this very, very delicate balance. And with all those things in mind, when you look at the top producers, I was moved a long time ago when I had Nancy Andres from Pine Ridge, Dan Dockhorn, and Kerner Rumbauer sitting down in a conference, and somebody asked them a very similar question. What do you guys think about Screaming Eagle and $1,000 bottle of wines and everything else that's out there? And how do you justify asking people to pay that much for it? And Nancy Andres gave a very political answer. You know, well, we look around and we examine all the costs and everything else and what we have to do. And Kerner says, look, I think I'm one of the best producers out there. So we look at what everybody else is doing and we try to price accordingly. And Dan Dockhorn, God, I love that guy. Dan Dockhorn goes, it's all your guys' fault. You're in your screaming burrito and flying taco and everything else, and your willingness to pay for whatever, and all you tech guys coming out there with more money than sense in your brains. If you want to give us a lot of money for it, we're going to take your money. Because I go out there and I buy all my neighbors' wines and I taste them, and we all sit down and we figure out what their prices are, and then we figure out where we're going to be. So you look at somebody like Black Ankle, who from day one has said, we want to make the premier wines in Maryland. We want to do something different than nobody else has ever done before. And so there is an economic equation to it, but there's also a positioning to it. There is a position that say, if we want to be the best wine, we're going to charge to be the best wine. And we're going to let everybody else chase us. Whether you like Crumbling Rock or not, it's a very, very good red blend.
Yeah.
It's a very good blend. If you don't want to pay the money for it, yeah, you've got a lot of other options to pay other prices. But the fact is, with them setting where they are and achieving what they did with the Governor's Cup and awards as the best wine of the state, they pushed Dave at Big Cork to say, well, I want that recognition too. And Dave went after it with his Petit Verdot, his Syrah, his Malbec, and they're all fantastic wines. And so, as Rachel alluded to, if you want to separate yourself from everybody else, there is a little bit of this understanding of you've got to have faith and belief in yourself. If I'm making the best wines in Maryland, I'm going to make the best wines and maybe I'm going to charge so that they're the best wines. And again, it feeds that demand and everything else. But having said that, I think we're getting away from the awesomeness that's in our glass. So I'd like to pull this back for a little bit to have Rachel talk about her fantastic Malbec. Because not only is it delicious, there's a few other people that thought it was pretty delicious too that aren't in this room.
Yeah.
Maybe we could share a little bit of that, Rachel.
Yeah. So I have ADD, so my brain tends to wander in that sense. But this wine actually, I'm always very honest whenever customers come into our tasting room. Whenever I'm actually doing the tastings and explaining about this wine specifically. In January of this past year, I was trying to figure out how I was going to make less skews, less different types of wine. I mean, I was getting borderline like 17 wines at this point, and like a 2,400 case of production in 1,400 square feet, under 1,400 square feet.
Slightly bigger than this room.
Yeah. I mean, this is actually the size of my barrel room, barrel area, not room, area. And I have basically three times three of this room. And that's a very small winery for 2,400 to 2,600 cases of wine produced a year. And so basically I decided in my head, I was like, you know, I'm going to stop producing Malbec because I'm going to keep working with it for blending. I know people love the Malbec, but as soon as I get to wine club to being a certain level, then I'll only make it for wine club. And because I can only make, I can't make 10 different red wines. This doesn't make sense. But we put it in Texom, which is this competition that is an international competition, is actually probably the hardest competition to get any awards in the United States or internationally. It is judged by wine writers, master sommeliers, and masters of wine. It is the hardest palates in this industry, basically. And there's over 2,400 to 3,000 wines that are submitted every year. We did very well in that competition in 2023 with my Cabernet Franc. And it's the wine that it's a competition that I felt like I've seen like producers like from McPherson and Texas and like these really amazing, cool producers do very well. And then like the winery just kind of like goes like this. And I thought, all right, I'm gonna like submit a bunch of wines. And I thought the Malbec was going to do the worst. Actually, I thought it was gonna do the worst. And I was like, someone else told me, let's put it in there. I said, sure. It got the highest award it could have received in that competition. And it got it basically beat out Catena Zapata. I don't know if you're familiar, Catena. It beat out a 94-point rated Malbec that sells for $120 a bottle. And I was like, a Malbec from Maryland? Yeah.
Their winery.
And it was funny because I talked to my uncle on the phone. I sent a whole, we have a WhatsApp with my whole family. And my uncle, who's like, I mean, he belongs to like massive amount of wine clubs in like Sonoma, very high end, you know, exclusive ones. He calls me and he goes, so Rachel, what did we learn here? I'm like, it's not coming out of the program. And he's like, nope, it's not. But else, what did you learn? And so, I mean, the thing was, is that it was a win for us.
This is Rachel.
It was also a win for the grower that I buy the fruit from. At my family's winery, we don't really grow. We don't grow most of the fruit that I work with. We're in a rebuilding phase still. And I actually personally, because I mentioned something before about it's not a cold, hot, hearty grape. I actually have no interest in growing Malbec. It's a very interesting variety because the first time I ever worked with it, I picked up the fruit from this vineyard. I drove it 38 minutes to the winery, and there's no flat land on our property, so I had to like back up the U-Haul truck, and so I mean it's not like probably OSHA approved, but anyway, I started seeing leaking out of the truck. I was like, what's going on? I open up the back, and I'm seeing like we're pulling out each like container, each lug, and the Malbec is a mess. And this is in 2020. The Malbec was a mess. I mean, there was like mud everywhere. We were slipping and sliding. And so I contacted grower. I'm like, well, I saw you put the fruit in the truck. It was beautiful fruit. And he goes, Rachel, there's a term for Malbec called juicing. As soon as Malbec hits a lug, a container, it starts to deteriorate that because that's how thin the skins are. And that is why I have a whole complex about Malbec. So it's really an interesting thing to think about that when you're working with a variety that literally degrades within 40 minutes of picking up the fruit that was cold in cold storage. I mean, like there's no other reason for it. It does this every year. I thought I cannot work with it in a way that will make an Argentinian Malbec. And I thought of Martin from Chateau Femme. So it was funny. We just tried his, like, you know, a couple wines ago. And I was like, oh, this reminds me of my wine. Because it is eerily similar because, I mean, I copied him. But, I mean, like, it's very different way because I don't know what yeast he, I don't know what anything else he does. I just know that, like, the style in my head from how I remembered, in my mind of how I remembered how he made it, just from, like, this, how it tasted from years prior. I don't know any of his practices. I can't say anything else about that. My personal rule of thumb is if something's going to be called a single variety on my label, it's 90% and above. The federal regulation is that if you don't see the name of the grape varieties as a blend on the back, then it can be 75% of that single variety and above. My perspective, again, that's cheating. So this is 90% Malbec, 7% Cabernet Franc, and 3% Petit Verdot. Everything we do is Maryland grown. This was barrel aged for about 9 months and mostly neutral oak, as in neutral, as in it's had second use or third use. And then I like a little bit of Hungarian oak, which gives it a little bit of that chocolatey note. I have less than five cases left of this at the winery. They released it in February. Well, wine club only in February, because after I got notice of, like, the fact that it did so well in that competition. I did bring one bottle of my 2023, which is not released. It's better. And so, yeah, Malbec's staying in the program, and I can't get rid of it. Honestly, I may have a Cabernet Sauvignon that I made in honor of him. That's $54 a bottle. I think my family, we've had debates of whether or not we would even have
what
that
were
price
you thinking?
Point. Yeah, like my aunt and my mom were like, he would have never liked that. Like, but this has his name on it. Yeah, no, but I have a bottle we'll open if you want to try it.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if anybody wants more wine out of Malbec.
Yeah.
Well, like, I'll tell you what, I'll be happy to do the honors and to bring around some of the new yet to be released wine, just as a thank you for everybody coming out today.
Yeah, but just because of an award, I'm not going to increase the price by $20. It's not right. Yeah, you know, we've had big debates in my family. So we made a Petit Verdot in 2021 and in 2023. So in 2021, we were talking about the price point. We went and he's like, well, what is Lingonor selling for? What is everyone else selling for? And, you know, Lingonor was selling theirs for $45 a bottle. Well, no, their wines are, you need to retry their wines. But and they have a whole new brand that's getting launched. But anyway, it was something that was really interesting because he was floored. Because he was used to selling wine for at the most $20, but it costs way more than that to make it. So yeah, but honestly, in my perspective, this is what the wine is worth. And so I mean, I've worked in all aspects of this industry where because of the fact that I worked in retail, I worked in distributing, and I worked with the winery, I know what the wine will sell for. I would rather it sell out within 8 months than hold on to it for 3 years.
I'll let you know a little secret.
Start to lose money.
There wasn't going to be any losers in this tasting. There weren't going to be any losers in the tasting. Just the different degrees of love. I cheated.
So.
It's not bad, huh? The Maryland one.
Yeah, I mean, their wines are really beautiful. I mean, I love their reds more than I love their whites, but I love their reds. I haven't tried their sparkling recently. I don't know if I've tried it yet. Yeah, I haven't gotten to try theirs yet. So I actually have a bottle, but I haven't opened it.
So.
Yeah, I have it somewhere. I think I have it in my closet. I think I have it in my closet or something. Yeah.
So we have some friends who.
Am I? Really?
If you have an empty glass or have one of your other little tasting glasses, Again, I'll come around and I'll pour the 2023 Lowell Vineyards Malbec for you.
So if I can talk about the 23 real quick.
I'd like to just direct your attention to Rachel because she's going to tell you a little bit about the difference between 2022 and 2023.
So 2022 was at that point in time was almost like an iconic vintage for us. I mean, we were pretty traumatized after 2018 where we're like, we had like, I don't know, like 17 days of like sunlight throughout the whole entire summer. But in 2022, the fruit was beautiful. And in 2023 was like, we had a California-like summer last year. We had less rain actually in our growing season than California did. So I thought was really funny, and sometimes I laughed and I felt bad about it, but like I really didn't like I thought I mean, but like we actually had like ripeness and it was crazy. I mean, and the color, I mean, so you'll see the color of this versus my 2022, and this is vibrant. It's violet. I mean, I have no control over this in the sense that this is like fermented on skins for the same amount of time as the 2022, but the fact that we had such intense colors those year. I mean, everyone was like, didn't know how to handle the red wines that year from on the East Coast because of the fact that we had such a drought basically, and no one expected it. I mean, we had like, for what our harvest was typically, let's say it started in the beginning of September, it started like 2.5 weeks prior because of that, because of the fact there's no rain and it was really hot. So this is 92% Malbec, 92.4, but like, I didn't want to put that on a label. And then like 3.7% Merlot and 3.9% Cabernet Franc. But I just put 92, 4, and 4 to make life easy. I like to put those on the, I like to put that aspect because then.
It's very Miguel Marino of you.
Yeah. Well, I put that on my, really? Yeah.
You're but, so honest.
What?
You're so honest.
I can't help it.
Yeah. Her grandfather's going to haunt her if she's not honest.
I just think it's my grandmother runs a business. Well, she's a owner of the business. I run the business. She's 87. She's the boss. She keeps me on like in check. I keep her in check. She reminds me of things all the time. So it's really great. We're like best friends. So, she's kind of like a sister, a grandmother, and a best friend all in one. It's kind of crazy. But anyway, the color on this, I think, is really wild. It's really pretty. It has more intensity than the 2022. I bottled this in beginning of August of this year. So it has a lot more time to still like chill out and figure its life out. I mean, it's still a wild teenager. It needs to be like a little bit more... Yeah.
Needs a year abroad.
Yeah, it needs a year abroad. It needs to have its full-time job, like, figured out and, like, rent its own apartment and, like, not have to be doing drugs or something.
No Mega Purple for you ever.
No. So I'm debating. I mean, I have, like, 5 cases left of the 2022. I get very excited. And it will go first to Wine Club. So it'll probably go first to Wine Club. I'm thinking February, I have been trying to get smarter when it comes to releasing wine because, you know, in Europe, they wait on wines and they wait till they're ready. And I find it really fun to show wines before they're ready and during when they're ready and then when they're at their like best tasting, because then customers get to see the evolution of it. And I think that is something that's really special. Now, this will get first released to Wine Club. I won't put this in the market probably maybe till May, but I'm saying this and I just put it in Texom. So we'll find out. And if I get an award, then I might be like, F it, let's just do it. I've been known to do that.
Or maybe if you're worried, you just should join the Lions Club.
Yeah. So I haven't tried it yet, but. I think 95 cases. Yeah, but I'm trying to hold on to it. Yeah. But this one was like 3 months out of the bottle. So, but this has been holding on. I mean, that's the thing also with Malbec that we don't really think about. I mean, actually, it's so interesting about all of these is that the there is tannic structure in them, but Malbec is so tannic. I mean, it's like, chalk. It takes all the water out of your mouth. And this is a really good indicator of, for me, like it doesn't actually start tasting like it's like velvet. Like I have two different versions. Like this one was like more like velvet and this one's like so tannic until it gets to like month eight. So I try to wait till month eight. I try. I get so impulsive. But I mean, I got to learn lessons at some point, but.
But again, and it's hard if I can bring it back. This is why we wanted to do this tasting. Here's now seven glasses, two rosés in front of you. To me, nothing tasted the same. Nothing at all. True. Again, even though we're dealing with the same grape, and in many cases we were dealing with 100% varietally pure, you see that there's a lot of range, and none of these were your syrupy, sticky, sweet blueberries and vanilla syrup Malbecs, which are out there and you can find them and you can have them. But to me, what I love is ending with a local Maryland Malbec that 100% holds its own and still stands out. Not just holds its own and is there in the conversation, but can lead the conversation. Can be that thing that we say, oh, okay, and this is why we want to do this series, and this is why we want to dive into this, is to really do this deep dive on these different grapes and show you why we love them so much, or why even when we hate them, we can find a reason to love them, because what comes out is something that's super thoroughly enjoyable and can be, you know, a game changer, whether it be for Maryland, for your friends, for your plate, or even more, you know, to the point, for your Thanksgiving dinner next week. All of these are going to taste great with Thanksgiving dinner if you want to. I went back and I drank through the Mil Historias after going through everything. And even though we had all those tannins, the Mil Historias had super fresh pop to it. The Riccadel had more red fruits when I tasted that. The Bedell is in my glass right now. And again, I'm getting more of that acidity that the grape has, you know, and it's really bright and it's super fresh. You've got two different versions of Rachel's, and you put them in a blind wine tasting. I would love to do a three-card Marti with Martin's. And just say, all right, which one's the French? Which one's Maryland?
I would love for him to try it.
Yeah, actually, we can make that happen.
So the Mil Historias actually reminds me a little bit of Carbonix in a sense.
Absolutely.
And like that's that fruity, like the fruity, combined two words, fruity and fresh characteristics of like what you get with a Carbonix as in like Nouveau, like Beaujolais Nouveau. So that totally is a great option for Thanksgiving in that sense.
And probably going to give you more joy and happiness than a lot of bad Beaujolais Nouveau.
Yeah, I don't.
But that's just me.
Stop buying that.
Ladies and gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for coming out for this. This is our fifth one of these, and I think we finally got it. And potentially this recording will be up and available next week for everybody, so check it out online. Please, by all means, if you have not been, make the road trip up to Low Vineyards. As much as I love her Malbec, she's just releasing her brand new Nouveau that puts everybody's Beaujolais Nouveau to shame. She's got a killer wine named Ancestry that I think y'all love. And if you're not familiar with mead, you need to go and get an education on mead, because these are not honey wines like you've seen before or tasted before.
They're dry.
And the stuff that she's going to be coming out with, we had the joy of drinking with a local wine shop a couple of weeks ago, and Rachel was kind enough to let us go through and try all the barrels. I promise you, over the next 2-3 years, you're going to find some really fun things coming from Low. So tell your friends. If anybody wants to make any purchases, we'll be around with order forms. But for right now, thank you for showing up for another one of our wine events. Without you guys, we can't make these happen. Are there any other questions before we end the night? So the next wine event is going to be December 18th here at Vasilis. We are attempting to see if we can plan a few others, because here's my problem. Every December, those of you that have been around know that I try to do a very special wine tasting. In the past, we've had Il Boro, we've done Campanelle, we've done a bunch of really fun things. So every December, I try to do something that just says, look, this is great, and you guys came out to support us. So this year, I've decided to full-on embrace the best of 2024. And what I've done is I've invited all of the panelists that have been with us this year to come back and participate. And everybody gets to pick one wine, what they loved and drank this year that they think everybody needs to know about. So I don't know what the selections are. I know that two people already have responded, and they're both really itching to do some more bubbles.
I haven't.
But it's going to be wide open. It will be six of the best things that we drank all year long in 2024. The tickets went live yesterday on Eventbrite, so go ahead and look for them there. Or you can find me at Liquid Storyteller or liquidstoryteller@gmail.com. You can also go and harass Rachel because she, for some reason, has agreed to come back and do this again in December. So December 18th, we will be here again, and we look forward to seeing all of you. Here's all of you. Cheers.